Now, stress is a serious matter. I hope you realise that. All right. Before we start talking about what stress is, I want to talk briefly about what it isn't. Some of the common misconceptions that there are about stress. Because these really cause people, and Christians in particular, quite a bit of trouble when it comes to working out how we're to handle stress in a way that is glorifying to God. The first one that I want to talk about is that people regard stress as a kind of a hazard. If you walk very carefully, you might manage to dodge it. But a survey that was conducted in Manchester in England recently, when people were asked what they considered stress was, revealed that most people regarded it as something that was lurking at people's shoulders, waiting to give them coronary heart disease and cancer and nervous breakdowns and that kind of thing. Now, let me just say that that is not right. Stress out of control can do that. That's one of the negative aspects of stress. But in order to get a balanced, a right view of what stress really is, think about the motor car. Now, we read a lot in the newspaper and see a lot on television the results of accidents, the results of the motor car out of control, and the results are very disturbing and frightening. But you and I know that that's only a tiny fraction of the story of the motor car, don't we? Now, what most people in our community don't realise is that stress is very similar to that. That the negative effects that we hear so much about, we hear about because they're the story of the situation out of control that needs something done about it. We hear very little about the positive aspects of stress, which in point of fact are the main story of stress. Okay, so stress is not simply a hazard of modern life. Now what about the idea that it's a new disease of the 20th century? No? Good. Any disagreement with that? A new disease of the 20th century. This is one definition that I saw in the stress literature, that stress is a disease of the 20th century, now reaching epidemic proportions. Now, can you think of any biblical reason why that's absolute rubbish? Yes? Elijah? Yes? Back? Job? Yes? Noah? Jonah? What about Adam and Eve in the garden when they heard the voice of God? Must have felt a bit uptight, don't you think? Not a new disease. What about the idea of being a disease? No, surely not a disease. We'll be elaborating on that in a minute. It might be a factor in a number of diseases, probably in most of them. But stress by itself is not a disease, nor is it the only cause of any disease. Okay, the 20th century? Well, there is an epidemic in the 20th century. What is it? Godlessness, selfishness, yes, but not thinking along those lines. What about change? Just think about the aeroplane for a start. At the beginning of the century, there was no such thing as an aeroplane. And think about what we've got in these days. Think about things like computers, lasers, all those things. There have been tremendous technological advances in the 20th century. And many of us find some of these pretty stressful, do we not? And because we have things like aeroplanes, we have a thing that nowadays is called the global village. What's the global village? Yes, distance isn't any object anymore. I can get in an aeroplane and within what period of time get to London? Within 24 hours, can I? Anyway, it's very, very easy to get from one place to another in the world in these days. And so, the stable rural community, which was a feature of life at the beginning of the century, no longer exists, or exists very much less than it used to. And extended family groups have broken down. We have nuclear families. living in urban situations, isolated from one another, and things like family breakdown and crime and unemployment and all these things absolutely rampant. And these things are stressful. Okay, what about the third idea, and this is fairly common amongst Christians, that to feel stress is somehow unspiritual. Ruth and I heard the other day of the reaction of a minister to the fact that we were conducting stress and coping seminars for missionaries. He said something like, what's the world come to? That missionaries have to have seminars on stress management. Oh dear. Anyway, you can close your eyes now. Just close your eyes momentarily. And if any of you, be absolutely honest. Do any of you, put your hand up if any of you feel that to feel the effects of stress is unspiritual. Hands up. Okay, good. You can put your hands down and open your eyes. I found that generally about 50% of people, of Christians, will answer yes to that question. It was much less than 50% on this occasion. I'm not quite sure why. Yes?
Put your hand up if you feel guilty about feeling the effects.
All right, close your eyes again. I blew it. All right. Now, it is not unspiritual to feel the symptoms of stress. Is there any biblical evidence for what I've just said? Can you think of people? Well, we mentioned people like Elijah and so on. Jesus himself, we quoted it this morning, not once but twice. Jesus facing the cross said, now my heart is troubled. And that means deep agitation of spirit. And if we had time, we could think of other occasions when Jesus mentioned being under stress. So I think that we can fairly conclude that all the best people suffer from stress. Yes? Yes. Good. That's number three thing. We've had a hazard of modern life. These are things that it isn't. A hazard of modern life, a new disease of the 20th century, something unspiritual. Number four, a sign of personal inadequacy. All right, now I want you to look at these two things. Toby lent me that one. I had to buy this one. Now, if I know, I won't do it now because I don't want to have to keep on buying them, but I know that if I applied a certain amount of pressure to this ping pong ball, I would crush it. If I applied the same amount of pressure to this one, I wouldn't make much impact on it at all. Now, I ask you, which of these is better? Exactly. For what? Or that depends. I mean, if the game is ping pong, this is absolutely useless, is it not? If the game is tennis, no. Bad news. All right, so in Ephesians 2 and 10, it says, Ruth quoted it this morning, for we are his workmanship. And the word workmanship means specifically handcrafted by God. Unique. I am unique. We're thoroughly familiar with the concept of having unique fingerprints, are we not? For some reason or other, we're so used to that idea, it doesn't even make us feel amazed. But when you think about it, it is absolutely incredible. But spiritually speaking, we are also unique. We are unique in every way. And we are unique for the purpose that God had in mind for us before the foundation of the world. So if you are a ping pong ball, you don't have to feel that you are somehow inadequate or not as good as the next fella. You are absolutely perfect for the job that that God has in mind for you. Ditto, if you're a tennis ball and you think, well, I'm a bit insensitive or whatever, don't be dismayed. You are you. You're a tennis ball. Because you are you. And this is something to be pleased about, not something to feel sad about. Now, number five, I always mention because Ruth's a psychologist. Some people have the idea that stress is something invented by a psychologist to upset us. Right? Amy Carmichael. Do you read Amy Carmichael? Wonderful example of creative coping that we're going to be talking about later. Amy Carmichael in Edges of His Ways quotes this little poem by an unknown author. The centipede was happy, till one day a toad in fun said, "Pray, which leg goes after which?" That strained his mind to such a pitch, he lay distracted in a ditch considering how to run. And many people think of stress like that. If we think too much about stress, it'll make us all lie around in our ditches considering how to run. Well, we know that's not true too. Alright, so what is stress? Stress is, and there are at least 300 different definitions, probably more. Stress is, this is my definition, and no other definition that I've seen starts with that. God given. God gave it to us. Normal. Normal. Not a disease. It's perfectly normal. If a tiger came in the back door, it'd be perfectly normal for me to feel uptight. Physiological. Something that happens in my body. We're talking about that in a moment. Physiological response to something that I perceive to be threatening. I don't suppose we have a... Yeah. To perceive threat. Now, perceived is enormously important. And this gives us the key to coping. It's my perception of what's going on that is the key to coping biblically with things. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that if I'm crossing a six-lane highway and I fail to see the semi-trailer that's bearing down upon me, I will not feel any stress whatsoever until the point of impact. Right? On the other hand, I'm crossing, I look around, I see the semi-trailer, I feel stressed. Because I perceive that the semi-trailer is going to hit me. Okay? If I were a champion sprinter, I may not feel stressed. I know that I could get across before it hit me. Alright. So all of these things are tremendously important. The thing out there, the semi-trailer bearing down upon me, is the stressor. What I feel in me, this second I've seen it, is stress. Yes. Now a stressor can be something nice or something bad. It can be something imagined or it can be something real. Okay, now let's just do one little exercise. We haven't got any time for any more. I want you to use your imagination, girls. You're in your house by yourself at 3 a.m. and you have been suddenly woken by a noise in the kitchen. That noise might be a mouse. Perish the thought. Or it might be an intruder. Okay? Your response to it depends on your perception, doesn't it? Now there are some people, and I'm one of them, who whenever they're woken by a noise somewhere in the house and they're by themselves, always know that it's an intruder. I don't know whether you're like that. If you are like that, tell me how you feel. Give me some feedback. What sort of symptoms do you get? Pumping heart, yes. Breathless. Sweaty. Pale and sweaty. Poppy eyes, wide awake. Your ears, yes. You are lying there very, very still with your eyes popping, your face pale and sweaty, waiting for the next sound. And you are like this. Your muscles are all tense. You're very wide awake. You are, in fact, in the grip of the stress response. Muscles tense and strong, brain alert and clear. Why? Down a bit. Why? So that you can sock them in the jaw or run for your life. The fight, flight. Response. The fight, flight response. You see, some of us lie there working out where the golf stick is Other people lie there working out, wondering whether they can fit into the cupboard or underneath the bed and not be seen. Okay. Now, girls, take yourself back to that day when you were standing at the door of the church and the wedding march has just started and you're about to walk down the aisle to your beloved to take the plunge irrevocably, irreversibly. How are you feeling? Jakey? Jakey? How does excited feel?
Yeah.
If your heart goes bumpity bump, love, love, love. If your throat comes up in a lump, it's love, love, love. All right. You get what I'm saying. It can be something nice. It can be something not nice. It can be something imagined. It can be something real. But it's a stressor. And it causes this stress response. It is automatic, autonomic, for any medical people here. So that when that tiger comes in the back door, I automatically am uptight. I don't have to think, oh, I'll get uptight. It happens automatically. But what we need to grasp is the fact that it is a protective response. It is essentially a protective response. So that I can run out of this room faster than I've run for many years. When I was at the hospital at Ballymore, a man ran 10 kilometres carrying his 7-year-old daughter who'd just been bitten by a highly venomous snake. He ran all the way into the hospital. And his friends and relations came panting behind. Literally. He had the renewed strength to do it because of the stress response. Okay, now we have to press on and talk about some of the features of the stress response or of our response to pressure that are very important. Now, I don't want you to get all uptight about this and think, I haven't seen graphs since I was at school, I won't understand it, etc., etc. Now, pressure is applied to me, and as pressure is applied to me, so my stress energy rises. You see, we are socialised not to sock people in jaws and not to run away. We are socialised to stand and face the music, aren't we? And so therefore the stress energy rises up inside us. See, if I could, when I felt angry with you, I could just sock you in the jaw, I would feel better because some of that stress energy would be discharged. An equal and opposite calming response would come into play and I would feel better. But as it is, I can't sock you in the jaw, so the stress energy just keeps mounting. Now, up to a point, this is a good thing, because it brings us up into this zone where we're performing best. We need a certain amount of stimulation, a certain amount of stress energy before we'll perform at our best. If we're sitting with our feet up, having a nice little read and someone asks us to do something, it's much harder to get going and do it than if we're very busy and someone asks us to do something extra. Is that not right? Yes. That's because, on the second occasion, you're in your zone of best performance. Now, if more and more pressure is applied, then you reach this level, which is your limit of pressure tolerance. Is there anyone here who doesn't have a limit of pressure tolerance? Right. I'm glad you realise that. We all have our limits of pressure tolerance. They may vary from day to day, from situation to situation, depending on what else is happening to us. Elijah was mentioned. Now, Elijah had this marvellous experience on Mount Carmel when the prophets of Baal were totally defeated, and then the very next day he gets a little bit of extra information that Jezebel's after him, and he goes into overload and runs. The fight-flight response has come into play and he runs and we find him sitting underneath the juniper tree feeling, having the symptoms of stress overload. We'll be talking about that in a minute. Okay, so we need to realise that we all have our limits of pressure tolerance. We also need to realise what we all really know, that stressful things add up, do they not? We had things in Papua New Guinea called kerosene refrigerators. I don't know whether any of you have ever lived with a kerosene refrigerator. I believe they're instruments of Satan, I really do. Anyway, one of my jobs in our household was to keep the Caro fridge going. And if I came home from the hospital really worried about a patient or two and somebody said that the fridge is out, then my response would be, oh no, I can't cope with that. This is the last straw syndrome I'm talking about, and this is what happened to Elijah. But if I came home from the hospital and everything was going fine and somebody said the fridge is out, I'd say, oh well, that's all right, just simply light it. Do you understand what I'm meaning? In the first case, everyone's nodding very meaningfully there, in the first case I'm already under a lot of pressure and you've just told me one little extra thing and it's pushed me over into overload. And I've developed the symptoms of stress overload. Now, there's a certain tennis player who illustrates this process very well. He and his partner are going along nicely, operating in this zone, round about up here, and this tennis player perceives that a wrong line call has been made. It doesn't matter whether or not it was wrong. His perception was that the thing was wrong, and so he does his lolly, as they say. While he is doing his lolly, his opponent is trying to ignore the whole business. However, eventually, after this has gone on for a while, what happens is that the first man lets off some of his steam, gets back into his zone of best performance, and the opponent has had a little bit of extra pressure added to him, so he goes over into his overload zone. And so after all this is finished, often you see the course of the match change. Have you noticed that? Well, that's what's happening as I understand it. Okay, so stressful things add up and therefore the last straw syndrome is real. Now when we're operating in this area, we are very vulnerable. And the other side of vulnerability is creativity. When I'm at my most vulnerable, I also have my greatest potential for being creative. Now that's very important and we're going to come back to that later. The other thing that I need to say at this point is, what are the symptoms of stress overload? We all have slightly different symptoms, but some are basically the same. All right, but you're not yourself. You're not yourself. You're irritable and you tend to be weepy and all this kind of thing. And the next thing is that you get some familiar physical symptoms. Ever since I had shingles, which affected my right eye, if I'm really tired and under stress, I get a sensation of a watery right eye. We all have different kinds of physical symptoms that we get. It might be back pain or neck pain or pain somewhere else. And this is the effect of the muscles being tense. Oh, I forgot to mention to you that the reason why you have this stress response is that blood and oxygen are being pumped away from the organs where you don't need blood and oxygen temporarily to the ones where you do. Thus the extra strength and the very clear thinking. Okay, I should have mentioned that. Sorry, I didn't. And some of these familiar physical symptoms are due to that. Tension in your muscle gives you the muscles, gives you pain in the neck, your headache, your backache, your pain in the stomach region, etc. Okay, constant tiredness. Being prone to get infections, colds and all kinds of things because your immune system is affected. And then this is a good one, helpful input from family and friends. That's very good. You know, no need to bite my head off. Why are you so touchy in this? What's the matter with you? These kinds of things. And then not doing your work so well. Well, we understand why that's happening, don't we? Because we've gone over into overload. We've been pushed over into this zone, so we're not performing the way we used to. We can't do our work as well as we used to. And one symptom that's worth mentioning by itself is loss of sense of humour. This happened to me the other day when I was in the throes of preparing for this weekend. We had a friend staying with us and she was telling me all these jokes and I could hardly raise a smile at any of them. Okay, temporarily in stress overload. All right, symptoms of stress overload. Ruth, come. Ruth's going to talk about some other things. And we'll have morning afternoon tea.
Cass always already said to us that stressful things add up, and some researchers, some psychologists have done some studies on it, and they interviewed thousands of people, and these men were called Holmes and Ray. Ray spelled R-A-H-E. And they've drawn up a shed, if you write on the board, they won't. Oh. And they've, after interviewing thousands of people and working out the impact of certain events on people's lives, they've come up with this schedule of life change unit points. So that the most stressful thing, and this is after interviewing all these people and finding an average of how an event affects someone, the death of a spouse, they gave 100 points to, and then they went down the scale. Divorce, 73, marital separation, 65, jail term 63, and it goes right down to Christmas gives a stress point of 12, and so that there's good things like Christmas, a new baby, marriage. Where's marriage? Number 7, 50 points. And so what they do with this is to, if someone's feeling, having a lot of symptoms, not as well as they usually are, getting a lot of infections or something, they add up for the last 12 months how many changes have been in that person's life. And what they've found is that if they get a score of over 150, there's a 50% chance that in the next couple of years that person will have some major health changes. If it goes up to 300, there's a 70%, and if it goes over 400, there's an 80% chance that that person will notice some change in their health. And this is very helpful to realise that if you're finding that you're not coping so well and you're wondering, you're saying to yourself, I've always been able to cope with life, I've been a good coper. Look back over the last year and see the things that you've had to put up with. And this is why when there's been a bereavement, someone's lost a spouse, it's not good in the next few months to make major decisions like suddenly selling your house and moving. When we were growing up, our father was in the post office and we moved town regularly. And people find that when they move, they've got to change their house, their friends, their church, perhaps their salary, perhaps the husband's got more responsibility, the wife's got to cope with the kids going to school, and they find often that there's a whole series of infections. We have found that when a missionary goes to their place to work for the first time, the score goes up to about 480. They're changing everything. From a good job with a good salary, they're going down to a minimal allowance. From a church where they were supported and felt at home, they might go into a great big, like Ethiopia, great big auditorium, sitting on benches with no back for 2-hour services in a language that they didn't know. And so they're learning the language. Perhaps they're just married. They've got that already to cope with. The wife might get pregnant. So all these things add up. Now, a lot of people take it in their stride. They might have a score of 400 and not get sick. The things that might affect that is that they're really committed to what they're doing. They know that they're doing the Lord's will. They've been well prepared for the changes. But some people cannot cope with all these changes. And the reason that we share this is that when we aren't coping, it is helpful to look back and say, well, this has happened. And this has happened, and they have been stressful for me, and they have added up, and the normal, average people have a reaction to all these changes. Any more?
No.
It was very interesting what Kat's just written on the board, that another secular psychologist called Kubasa looked at people that didn't get sick after a huge number of scores, and they found that challenge, commitment and a feeling of being in control affected the person's health. And we know as Christians that often the Lord gives us the strength to go through these things. But it is also good to realise that when we've had a lot of changes, that before we make another major decision, it's good to take some time out to look at what's happened and to realise that if we have another major change, that it's going to be another stressful thing to add to our school.
I was just saying that challenge is a person, where a person perceives a stressful thing as challenge rather than as threat, then they are much better able to cope with it. And we as Christians don't ever see things as out of control because we see that God is in control. So it's interesting that a secular person... You're coming back, are you?
Yep.
Yeah. A secular person came to this conclusion just studying people with high resistance to life change, that they showed these characteristics. And to us as Christians, of course, they make 100% sense.
Now, Kat's already shared with us about the tennis ball and the ping pong ball, and sometimes she says we're either draft horses or race horses, and we need to accept that. And this comes in very helpful. A lot of my work involves assessing people who want to be missionaries, and we realise that some people do have the artistic temperament. They're very gifted in creative ways, and when a person has that highly creative ability, they are going to be more finely tuned. And if you find that that's how you respond, to accept the way that the Lord has made you, that what some of these things are harder to cope with in some ways. And when people are being creative, like the prima donna syndrome, there was a television series on Maria Callas not long ago, and it said that often a performance had to be cancelled. She just couldn't go. There she was, world famous singer, and performing at her best every night for these crowds, and that is the cost. That kind of temperament finds it harder to cope with very stressful situations. Another thing that we have to take into consideration is our own background, the way we are, the messages that we have received as we've been growing up. Why do some people get really, really uptight when they're going to be late, and other people can take it in their stride and walk in 20 minutes late without turning a hair? Oh, I know someone, if you say, what time will we leave in the morning? He says 6 o'clock. And you think, right, I've got to be ready by 6. 20 to 6, he's out in the car with it packed, revving up, and the people going with him haven't even got out of the shower. And you say, well, it doesn't matter, you said 6 o'clock. But really uptight, frightened that we're going to be late. Always the first at everything. Well, obviously the message has been received and recorded in the computer in the head, you must be early. If you're late, you're not okay. But we had missionaries like that. Some of the things that we cope with on the mission field is putting all these different people together and expecting them to get on. Some people very punctual, always on the dot. Others who just don't mind, it doesn't worry them. Some people have got to have the house very spick and span. I lived with a girl who was from Germany, and her house was so clean and so tidy, and mine, just to look in our linen cupboards was a revelation of people's personalities. Once I followed her into her bedroom because she was going to lend me something, and she opened up the linen cupboard and my eyes nearly popped out. It looked as though everything had been ironed onto the shelf. It was just so neat. And my mind went back to mine, where if I opened the door I had to duck or I might get knocked out by the avalanche. And one day we were having visitors and I saw how uptight she was. I washed the floors, I did the dusting, I made the cake because she was busy, and when she came home and inspected it, I felt like a trainee nurse with the charge sister coming around looking, and she went and got a duster and she redusted the windowsill and I was deeply hurt. And I didn't say anything, I just went away insulting. But someone said to me later, another German girl, she said, you would have no idea about her background. In that area of Germany, if visitors are coming, they spring clean the whole house and they show people in the cupboards. They take them. I mean, there's no way I could do that. We can't even open our bedroom door because everything out of the, off the kitchen table's been put on the bed and the door shut. Yes, yeah, so Kat said sometimes we can't open our front door. There's something jammed against it. But these are things that we have grown up. They're messages that we've received, and it's no one's fault. It has been instilled. It's there. And so some people will get very uptight. Now, if there's a knock on the door and the beds aren't made and the breakfast dishes aren't done, and you think, oh, what will I do? I can't let them in to see all this mess. Other people don't mind. Come in. I haven't had time to do the dishes, and they don't care. They're not stressed. Well, the thing that makes us like this, one way of looking at it, and this is in the book The Stress Myth, it is our stability structure, the way that we are made. The things that cause me to be stressed might not make you stressed, and vice versa. So one of the things that we have to learn when we're learning stress management is that often we have to change our thinking about a certain thing. We might have to say, well, what if the house isn't tidy? I've got to learn to live with that. Perhaps people have grown up with the idea, if I'm to be a successful parent, my children have got to turn out a certain way. And when the children start going their own ways, because they're individuals and make their own decisions, then it's like this. And the parent has to learn to change, to learn that these children are individuals and their thinking has to change. So that's what we call a stability structure, accepting the fact that our past experience has made us a certain way, has made us think in certain ways, and given us different abilities to cope with things that come into our lives and to learn to cope with when it's not just the way we thought it would be. And if you want to understand that a lot better, that's in the stress myth. But what we need to ask ourselves is, I'm all uptight, what is the nature of what is happening to me? Why am I feeling stressed? Is it my idea that I have to be 10 minutes early at such and such a place, or my house has to look in a certain way, or this and this has to happen for me to be all right? Otherwise, I'm going to have stress symptoms and not cope very well. Now we'll have a cuppa.
Now I thought it would be good before we get on to coping if we just thought about some of the things that contribute to our vulnerability. Remember, we were talking about when we're operating up here at our very best performance, we are at our most vulnerable. And the prima donna may either go into overload and do his or her lolly, or produce some magnificent performance. Okay, now let's just think about some of the things that contribute to our being vulnerable. What are the things, just call some of them out.
Kids.
Some, they come.
Kids.
Life situation.
Oh, what about that husband?
Right.
Relationships.
Yes. What do we call that? Physical health.
Physical. Your hormone level.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. If we're not on top physically, we're much more vulnerable to extra pressure, aren't we? What else?
Tiredness.
We'll put that under that one. Yes.
Age.
Yeah. Age. Would you like to elaborate on that? What would you like to say about age?
If you're getting older.
Yes, as you're getting older, on the other hand, you might...
You don't seem to have the patience that you have as you get older.
Yes, as you get older, when your coping muscles have been developed a bit more, perhaps, so you're able to cope a bit better. Yes. Not coming to grips with the realities of the situation. Yes. So that's your, what do we call that? Yeah, psychological state. That's our physical state, our psychological state. Refusing to draw a line. You know, I had this problem when I came back from Papua New Guinea. for years, I didn't really face up to drawing that line and saying, well, I'm not going back. Now I have to get on with life here. And this is one of the therapeutic things about the funeral, that the funeral is a symbolic drawing of a line. And we have all together said, we give thanks for this life, but this life is over now, and we have to pick up the threads and move on. Psychological state. Right. Now, under relationships, what were we thinking of? We were thinking of difficult relationships, but what about the other side of it? What about the support that comes from relationships? We all know that if we've got someone beside us who loves us and cares about us, we're going to be able to cope with a lot more than if we're by ourselves, right? Or if the person beside us isn't able to provide that kind of support. All right, what else did we talk about? The way I am. Yes. Everything that makes up the way I am. Okay, well, these are some of the things that contribute to my vulnerability, and we have to exercise our common sense and recognise that when these kinds of things are on the negative side of normal, we're going to be much more susceptible to any extra thing. So let's not add guilt to our problems if we find ourselves getting uptight more readily than we used to or that we normally do. All right? The other thing I want to talk about before we go on to coping is just to have a look at the purposes very, very quickly. The purposes of our stress response. And we mentioned one of them earlier. Do you remember what it was? Protective. Right. The tiger came in the back door and my stress response immediately came into play so that I had the extra strength to run 100 yards in 10 seconds flat. Right? What else? Well, that's part of the protection one. Okay, can you think of anything else? We've been talking about it. Performance. Our best performance. Our stress response isn't all a negative thing, is it? It's a God-given normal thing for definite reasons. Now, as we look at the scriptures, we see other things coming in, and we were talking about them this morning. The effect of trial. What does trial do? And as a result of testing, makes us grow. Our own spiritual growth. And what did Paul say? That he had experienced the comfort of God and that had turned him into a comforter. Ministry. Now, looking at that stability structure overhead that Ruth was showing us before, recently I was at a seminar when the matter of breaking bad news to people with life-threatening illnesses was under discussion. And one of the doctors there said that he didn't break the news to his patients because what happened was this. They came to pieces. Right. And one of the other doctors there said something really good. He said, ah yes, but when the pieces come together again, they're in a much better position. And I think this is something very important for us as Christians in particular to come to grips with, because a thing like the news of life-threatening illness is something that we can't do much about. We can't do anything about it. The reality is that I have a life-threatening illness. So if this situation is going to be made right, if the pieces are going to be come back together again, it's not going to change. So as Ruth's already said to us, what has to change is me. And that's all right, because as Christians we're committed to change, are we not? We are being transformed more and more into the image of his Son. And as we were thinking about this morning, one of the great facilitators of that process is trial, pain, being tested, highly stressful situations. All right, now going on to coping. What is coping, first of all? Well, coping, really, is the action that we take in order to get back into the situation where we're able to carry on as normal, or the action that we take to prevent ourselves from going into stress overload. It's a strange thing. It's not only at home that I lose things. Oh, here we are. Here we are. So, all right, I've gone over into overload. Coping is what I do to get back here again. Or coping is what I do to stop myself from going over there because the red light is on. I know I'm beginning to develop certain symptoms. My eye is feeling a bit watery. So I take some kind of action to prevent myself from going into that situation. And in essence, up to a point, that's what coping is. I say up to a point for reasons that will be clear a little bit later. All right, now, stress management is something that we hear a lot about. And stress management really is like taking an aspirin because you have a headache. It's focusing on the emotion, focusing on what I'm feeling. Emotion-focused coping. I've gone over into overload. In order to continue now, something has to be done. I have to blow off steam in order to be able to continue. That's, in essence, what stress management is. Now, can you suggest to me some ways of stress management that you know of, beg pardon?
Go for a walk.
Go for a walk, yes. Now, in going for a walk, if it's a vigorous walk, what you're doing is exercising these large muscles which are all ready for fight or flight. So it's a very logical way to get rid of some of that surplus stress energy. Exercise of whatever kind. Yes?
Talking.
Talking? Yes? Talking to whom?
Somebody that you can trust.
Getting it off your chest to a friend, a trusted friend. Very therapeutic. On the mission field we had a thing called the aorta syndrome. You know, we said to one another, I ought to do this and I ought to do that. And we said it very vigorously to one another sometimes. And it was a very good way of getting the stress level down to the point where you could continue to cope. Okay?
Talking to the Lord.
Right. Prayer. Some people write letters. I write the letter of resignation and then tear it up. All right, that kind of thing, yes? What else?
Hobby.
Yes, do something you enjoy. All right, there's another big category we haven't thought of.
Scream.
Well, that's, yes, all right, expressing your emotion, I guess, yes.
Right, at this 4 a.m.
Express in an acceptable way, e.g. good cry. Cries are good, did you know that? They're good because of the substance that's in tears. It's like morphine. It has a sedative effect on you as you're crying. So that's something really good to grab hold of, and that's why it's good for men to cry, not just store it up inside them. Okay, and express in other ways, not kicking the dog or that kind of thing, harmlessly in an acceptable way. And what was the other thing, making a list? Yes, I think that comes into the problem solving part. We're just talking about just trying to do something about the actual emotion. The other big section that I have here is doing something to calm yourself. Relaxation, calming, breathing, these kinds of things are many different ways of coping. Now, all this is like the aspirin for the headache. It just relieves the pain temporarily, but doesn't do anything about the cause of the headache. Right? So that we can keep our stress energy at a certain level by using these kinds of methods, but we're not doing anything on a permanent basis. So the next thing I want to talk about is situation management or problem-focused coping. You're focusing on the underlying problem. Now, one thing that you can do is to take action to reduce, if you can, reduce the size of the stressor. Reduce the total pressure that is on you by just focusing on the situation. Now, what kind of thing might you do there?
Say no.
Say no, yes. Right. So you're really talking about replanning, reviewing and replanning your life, or reorganising your life so that you just get through things one at a time.
Okay? Into little bits, so you can handle one at a time.
Yes. A friend of mine was severely burnt, and when I went to see him one day and said, "How are you going, John?" he said, "Well, I'm just living from needle to needle, really." And sometimes when we're in a severely stressful situation, that's all we can do. But that's all that we have to do, because now is all that we have to deal with. And learning simply to deal with the stressful things in bite-sized pieces, needle to needle, can be a very useful way of reducing the total amount of stress that is on us at any one situation. We often put a great deal upon ourselves by worrying about what's up ahead, and half the time it never happens anyway. Okay, what else can we have in that section? Also under that come the VDPs and the VIPs. Anyone read Gordon MacDonald's book, Restoring Your Spiritual Passion? He talks about the VDPs, they're the very draining people who grab the time that you want to give to your VIPs. And you have to work out some way of organising your VDPs so that they won't do that. And there are ways and means of doing this. All right. There's the TDT method that we use in Papua New Guinea. Train, delegate, and what's the third one? Trust. It's no use training if you don't delegate. And I guess this applies to your children. I mean, you can train your children to do jobs around the house, but if you don't let them do it, well, it's all to no avail. And then if you don't trust them with what you let them do, that may be very wise not to trust them, of course. But if you don't trust them, then the whole thing falls flat on its face. All right.
Coming to terms with the situation.
Yes, and that's under the next section which we're going to talk about, which is reducing the power of the stressor. reducing the power of the stressor. The stressor is the same, but it doesn't have the power over you. It doesn't have the power to upset you in the way that it did. So in other words, what you're doing is changing your perception of the thing. You're changing your perception both of the thing that's upsetting you and of yourself and of your relationship to God and how that comes into the situation. Okay, reducing the power of the stressor. And this is where we're going to be talking about changing, thinking about it. And Ruth's going to be talking to us about that in a minute. But the fourth one that I want to talk about is most important for Christians. And this is what I call, now we're in a different section, aren't we? Creative coping. Do you remember this morning when I was talking about perseverance? I said it wasn't just enduring with gritted teeth. It was making something, creating something out of the raw material of the situation. Now, even though I'd love to go on listening to it. All right, what was that?
Nescafe ad.
Really? Have I got that in a Nescafe ad? Oh, dear. All right, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, that is. Now, I just want to read you something out of the biography of Beethoven. To the vast majority of people, suffering is still one of the fundamental characteristics of life. And it is their realisation that an experience of suffering, pure and profound, enters as an integral part into Beethoven's greatest work, that helps to give that work its unique place in the minds and hearts of men. Now, some people think Beethoven was head and shoulders above all other composers. Not everyone thinks that. Yet Beethoven never succumbs, he is never defeated, his view never goes limp, the colour of his work never turns wan or smudgy, nor does it contain an iota of cynicism. He never denies life, he balances suffering with solace, the legacy he leaves us is an assertion of strength. Then it goes on to say that in his communication with his friends, he does not give this kind of impression of strength in his letters, where he so frequently complains, bemoaning his fate. Now, there are two kinds of coping illustrated there. Do you know what the two kinds of coping are? He created this magnificent work out of the fruit of his pain and using the gifts that he had. Right? At the same time, he's writing to his friends complaining about the things that were happening in his life. What kind of coping was he using? Yes, creative coping. And? Yes. And that was? Stress management. I know it's a bit hard for you to come to grips with this idea of stress management just being a tiny fraction of coping, but that's the reality. He was getting rid of his surplus stress energy, on the one hand, by complaining to his friends, like the prima donna, creating some scene, but on the other hand, he's writing this magnificent music. And his biographer said that those first bars of the Fifth Symphony that we've just heard were the work of 8 years. He changed this particular part of the symphony 14 different times. So it wasn't something that came easily. Very gifted though he was, it was something that he had to work on to create something beautiful out of his pain and out of his God-given capacity. Now that's what creative coping is all about, and that's the challenge that comes to you and me. To create something beautiful for the Lord out of one, our pain, and two, our God-given capacities. And none of us can say, well, I don't have any capacities, because that's not true. We all have some capacities. It's a matter of identifying them and using them in the situation that we're in. So that is creative coping. Now, before Ruth takes over, I want to talk about one other thing, which is to be found in John 12, verses 27 and 28. Now I've lost my Bible. Now I've found it again. John 12, verses 27 and 28. And if you are like me, a person who writes in Bibles, then I recommend writing beside those verses the essence of coping. This is our model of coping. The essence of coping. John 12, verses 27 and 28. When Jesus said, and we've already quoted it three times today, now my heart is troubled, Jesus facing the cross, and what shall I say? Shall I say, Father, save me from this hour? No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. But I am sorely tempted to ask to be removed from this, because it is a deeply painful situation, far more painful than anything that you and I have had to deal with or face. And I'll just divert to talk about engagement. There's some very interesting work done with first-term missionaries. It's been found that the first-term missionaries who suffer most from culture shock, and that's stress overload due to being exposed to a new culture with all that involves, those who suffer most from culture shock in the end adjust better than those who just sail through it without any problem. Now, can you think of any reason why that should be so?
They should press it when they should get put on a mask and try and hide it.
No.
They become creative copers.
Yes. Yes.
They face the issue quickly.
They face the issue. And what is the issue?
They have a chance.
Yes, if I'm going to make a contribution in this culture, I have got to go through the pain of relating to the people from the other culture. Whereas some people don't have culture shock because they're not exposing themselves to the culture. They're withdrawing into a comfortable little European ghetto. Whereas those who get out, instead of ghetto, those who get out and expose themselves to the pain of relating to the culture, experience the culture shock, but later on, the adjustment. Now, as I thought about this, I thought to myself, now, what Jesus was really doing on the cross, amongst other things, was fully engaging the sin and the pain of the world, fully engaging it. And the more deeply we engage something, the more we're prepared to face up to a thing in all its reality, the greater the pain we're going to feel. That's why the pain that Jesus felt was far greater than anything that we've experienced. And I'm not talking only about the physical pain of crucifixion. The greater the pain we will face, but the more wonderful the result will be. So the more we're prepared to face up to the reality of our pain, the better the adjustment we're going to make, and the more God will be glorified. Now, that's not to say that denial has no place. And in working with cancer patients, I know that denial has an important place on a temporary basis. And when the pain is severe, taking some kind of sedative has a place too. After my mother died, after a fairly long illness in which we were all closely involved, she died at home. A number of weeks afterwards, I developed a reactive anxiety state. And my father was a doctor, a very wise person, and he said to me, "I'm prescribing Phenobarb for you." That was the equivalent of Valium in those days. I'm prescribing Phenobarb for you. It is not going to deal with your problem. It's just going to allow you to go on living while you are dealing with the problem. So if somebody wants to give you a sedative for a short period of time, don't feel that you're being unchristian or unspiritual to have it. The problem is when we go on and on with either denying the problem or having a sedative which keeps us from engaging with the problem. The problem is that if we have this for a prolonged period of time, we will never come to grips with the problem. We will never draw that line. It has to be drawn so that we can get on with life. And this is why, with people who are bereaved, some people say, well, they shouldn't be given any sedation at all. I don't believe that. I believe that when the pain is overwhelming, it's legitimate to use sedation. And similarly, with a cancer patient who's just received this overwhelmingly painful piece of news, it is legitimate for that patient to use denial for a short period of time. And when he or she is ready to receive the whole news, then he or she will give you the signal. There was a very interesting piece of work done with cancer patients where a whole group of them were given the news of their situation by one physician who told them all in the same way, and then several weeks later this group were questioned about what they'd been told. 10% said they had never been told. They were using denial, and it was very useful for that period. But you would find that as time went on, that number would get reduced to a negligible level. So that denial has a place, and so does sedation. And if somebody wants to deny something, don't stop them from denying it. Often when people are dying, you'll notice they fluctuate between saying, "Oh, well, next week I'll be out of here and I'll be out on the golf course," and saying, "And at my funeral, I want you to sing such and such." We need to understand this. And not get upset about the denial. It's just something that they have to use temporarily because the pain is too much. And they really understand that they are dying and they want their funeral to be just right. Okay. Engaging our pain with a view to drawing the line and being creative with our pain, creating something. I'll finish with this, but just to tell you one other thing about cancer patients, because I was working with them for a while, that at a hospital for the terminally ill in the United Kingdom, a poet was appointed to the staff as an experiment. It was a very successful experiment. That the job of the poet was to encourage patients who couldn't communicate the way they were feeling in any other way to express it in poetry. And in the British Medical Journal it was, several of these poems were published. And they were not only therapeutic to the people who wrote them, but also to the people who read them. The people who had never written poems in their life before, just writing in blank verse how they were feeling and communicating it to other people so that the other people were able to understand them better. But the mere act of communication helped them to get it off their chest. And those who read their work, like me, were encouraged in their own lives. So that was creative coping.